that mic.
For months, we've been trying to get our lapel mic fixed. The Sunday he's speaking, he's got it.
Aha. Uh-huh. Okay, well, thank you, John. All right. Now you know who I am. Thank you, John. I was just kind of watching the time, and I thought if he went on for too much longer, I could just say, well, and that's it. But he cut off at probably... No. That is not... This is a bit of a trick that I got to fit in here, because if I'm going to do this, I sometimes call John 12:15, because that's usually about when he ends. And so this is a tricky thing I got to do here, because I've got to go long enough so that we have completed the morning, but at the same time, can't make it too short, because then I'm a little worried that Pastor John will feel compelled to finish it off. So I'm aiming for a sweet spot in terms of timing of this message. And anyways, and so so you might be asking, I'm asking, what am I doing here today? And you might be asking, what is he doing here today? And so some of you might say, well, he's pitch hitting for Pastor John. And that sometimes is used as an analogy to say that someone's stepping in just to help the main man out, sort of thing. But, and this is a baseball analogy, but I can tell you, no. I am not pinch hitting for Pastor John. That's not what I'm doing here. Because in baseball terms, a pinch hitter is a very specialized, talented batter who could potentially knock one out of the park. And I doubt it. I honestly doubt it here. So that's not how we should look at my time here today. But staying with the baseball theme, I think I've come up with one that would maybe better describe my being here today. And it's more like bringing in a position player into a game to throw a few pitches. There's every once in a while, there's circumstances that come up in baseball where they don't want to use their main pitcher, or they don't want to use their talented bullpen players. The situation occurs that they just want to bring somebody in from left field and come in and throw some pitches in the inning just to kind of get us through. You know, it's usually would indicate that usually the game is out of hand or something like that. But it's someone you don't really expect very much from. And you just... You just hope that he can maybe get something across, like the odd ball across there. So let's go with that. So if some of my comments seem to come from out of left field, well, hey, there you go. So something else I want to acknowledge is the patience and understanding of Eleanor. And Eleanor does a wonderful job of putting a bulletin together every week, and I'm usually involved in setting up the PowerPoint and doing that. And so there's sort of a system that we got going, and usually John has a well-outlined, well-documented message and with all the points raised, and that gets sent out on Friday or Saturday at the latest, and I draw from that, and I build the PowerPoint, and Eleanor takes that and determines the theme, and she also condenses it into a bulletin form for you to follow, and it's just awesome how it works, and it's great, and it's just sort of like a well-oiled machine, and that usually works. But I'm speaking this Sunday, and so it's getting on later in the evening, and Eleanor phones and says, "Are you sending me anything for the bulletin?" And I said, Well, what's your title? And I says, well, my title is actually, Are You Kidding Me? And Eleanor says, okay, yeah. So do you have a Bible verse or something that you want to go with? I says, well, anyways, the gist of it is we figured it out, and I just appreciate Eleanor's. We decided on some things, and we got it working, and Eleanor was able to put a bulletin together, and I really appreciate her patience on this. But yes, that is the theme of my message, is Are You Kidding Me? And sometimes events found in the Bible can often make you wonder. And this, I know, is maybe a little bit of an unusual topic for a message, but please bear with me, and hopefully I do get at least one across or something like that. Remember, I'm coming from out in left field. And just before I go on, I know you guys have a pretty good understanding of the context of the term, Are You Kidding Me? Or Are You Kidding? Something like that. And often we use that term in terms of if we are surprised or something. And there's a wide range of contexts by which we use that term. And so I thought it would be, and not to insult your intelligence or anything, I just thought we'd maybe spend a little time in this just to make sure that we kind of give you a chance to think about it, and then maybe it'll apply better to the message. And so there are different contexts on how we use Are You Kidding Me? And the first one I just want to talk about is the hidden key. And this here is an example of, in my life, where that term was, the expression came out of. And Landon, is Larry on Zoom, by the way? Yes. Oh, good. anyway, so this goes back to time when I lived in a small town called Fenwood. It's about an hour from here, and it's just a really small community. And we had a family of about six kids. Well, not about. We actually had six kids. And so this is in the 60s. And, like, there's really was no reason, when I think about this, to ever lock the house. But this one time, anyways, different family members were going off in different directions. And my brother Larry, who was probably in his mid-teens at the time, ended up being the last one to leave the house. And I guess he felt compelled to lock the door. But, of course, in that time, you just had one key, and it actually looked a lot like the picture there. And so you just had that key. So anyways, so he locked the door, and then he thought, oh, so what if I'm not the first one back? So he couldn't take the key with him, but what he did do was he hid the key. So then he realized, well, you know, we didn't have a set hiding place for the key, so he better find a way to let the next person that might arrive know so they could access the key. So he left a note on the door telling where the key was in. This is a true story. And so, are you kidding me? So it can be something that really can show just kind of amused surprise that you'd do that. Anyway, now, continuing with some real-life situations to put some context in this. We go to a birthday party, and it was Dad's birthday. Not my dad, my father-in-law's birthday. And is Darcy on the Zoom? No. Anyways, so my father-in-law, what we used to do as a family would be to celebrate his birthdays. We usually went out somewhere and we gathered and we'd have a really nice meal and it was a wonderful family outing and everything. And Darcy and her sister, Deanna, usually we're coordinating this and made all the arrangements and everything, and we all look forward to it. And so this Friday night, I believe that it was time to do this, and I think we booked at Rock Creek in Regina. And so we all converged there, and we had the reservation made and the table all set up and everything. And we're sitting down, and we're just patiently waiting. And Darcy's dad lived in Fort Capel, so it was about a half-hour drive. And so he's probably just taking his time getting here, and so we were waiting. And we're waiting. And we're waiting, and he's not showing up. And after a while, you could say, hey, you know, this is not like him, because usually he'd be the first one there, but he wasn't. And so then somebody said, well, does he know about this? And it was at that point the are you kidding me expression might have come up, because Darcy looked at Deanna, and Deanna looked at Darcy, and do I need to say any more about this? He appreciated the phone call, and we told him what a wonderful time we had at his birthday party. So that's an example of an are you kidding me? Okay, I have one more. I don't want to go on this. Oh, man. Anyway, so it's worth it maybe. Anyways, not too long ago, so one of the here's a different context how we might use it. I was looking, my fingernails needed clipping, and it was a bright, nice, sunny morning, and I can walk out onto the deck, and I can just go out, and it was kind of handy, because it was nice being out there, and it was a good place to clip your fingernails, because then you're not trying to round them all up and everything afterwards, you can just let them fly. Anyways, so I'm out there doing this, and I'm holding my hand out like this, and I'm clipping away, and doing a good job of this. And there's trees and stuff around the edge of the deck and stuff. And all of a sudden, putch. I'm here literally doing this. I'm doing this and putch. A bird sent a backhanded comment to me. And I just looked at that and I said, are you kidding me? And so the context of that one was, well, that's not a very nice surprise, and can you believe that this happened to me? And so that could be another way that an are you kidding me can be used. Okay, but sometimes are you kidding me can be phrased and used in a more serious times when we may say it. And for instance, those were sort of the lighter ones, and now when we look at that in terms of let's say when we learn some serious news about a family member or friend, the initial shock, what we might actually be you might actually say is, are you kidding me? You know, and hopefully that's something that doesn't happen very often. But there are times when there's a serious side to this sort of expression. And there are other times when we hear about something that happened in the world that is hard to understand and could take place, we might say, are you kidding me? And an example, a fresh example of that is, I think of, is that whole scene with what happened to George Floyd. And when you looked at the news more than once, and you see other police officers standing around while that's happening to this man on the ground, and how awful that is, whenever I see that, I just say, are you kidding me? Where one of those other police officers did not have the presence of mind to step into that situation. Like, and so there are times where are kidding me is not something that is at all funny. And so those are just some of the ways that I thought that I would touch on this to put this in context. And hopefully most of the time when you're saying are you kidding me? It's something that you can have some real laughter about. But anyways, so that was my title, and it, you know, John told me, or I hope I'm not mistaken, that sometimes it's good when you make a sermon to give a title that puts a little hook in it, gets people interested. It worked. So, are you kidding me? It was what I went with. But in truth, where this comes, or the idea of my message today, and I'll do this briefly, I hope. Anyways, is in the year 2020, I set a goal to read the entire Bible. It just seemed that that, and so, and I did that through the context of our Daily Bread devotional, and they set it up so nicely. They have the message every day, and then one of the things they have in there is a Bible in the Bible in a year, and they give you a reading to do from the Old Testament and another reading to do from the New Testament, and you just follow it along, and you can just carry on through, and they go through that. And I actually really ended up enjoying that. It really ended up being a very good experience, and it gave you, for the most part, an understanding of what's in the Bible. There are so many hidden things in there. Not hidden, but they're just, a lot of times they're just not the kinds of things you come across. And there's lots of times that just reading those passages and those sections just gave you insights, and it just gave you thoughts that just by simply reading it that you may not have had, or inspirations, I guess, that you may not have had otherwise if you hadn't done that. And I think it gave you some understandings. And so from that, as I went through that, there sort of came through some common themes. Well, first of all, I should go back and say there are parts of reading in the Bible, there are some chapters that aren't as, they're tough slugging, let's face it. And so on those days, you might buzz through some of those chapters a little fast. But there are many, many, many chapters in there where there are stories and stuff that are just really fascinating, interesting, and good to learn about. And something that I sort of started to see was that it was interesting to see that people and nations who worship God, that you could see people and nations who worship God faithfully, and then there's people and nations that fail to follow God. And the thing about this was, I sort of realized this, that sometimes people and nations who worship God faithfully were doing this at a time when it would have been easy to not do that. And on the other hand, people and nations failed to follow God at a time when you thought that should have been really easy and obvious for them to do. And you could see a pattern of this. And the Bible, time and time again, as you went through this, this theme kind of came through. Did that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay, good. Because Landon wrote that down. So no. Are you kidding me part comes into play when they did this at a time when the opposite reaction is what you might have expected. And so that's kind of how I thought. And it could be in terms of kind of, and the are you kidding me might have matched the situation just like I was describing earlier. Okay, so the first one, and so what I want to do, and this is where things might, I'm just going to move through and hopefully, trust me, I'm not going to talk about the whole Bible. So that, because then we'd be getting closer to the later time. But I'm just going to highlight some things in some places here, and hopefully this kind of ties in and fits in with this theme that I've got going here. And the first place, and like there's just many, 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 many more examples of what I could have stated on this or used, but I decided that I'd like to go with one that's pretty obvious, and that's Noah. Like there are some incredible things there. And so Genesis 6, 9 to 14. Now the story goes on, and there's a lot to it, but I just wanted to just read some very basic parts, and Genesis 6, 9 to 14. And so it reads, "This is the account of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked with God. Noah had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, or whatever. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become for all the people on the earth and had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I am going to put an end to all people for the earth is filled with violence because of them. I am surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark out of cypress wood, make rooms in it, and coat it with pitch inside and out. And so that was what God told Noah to do. And as the story goes on, you know, of course, he followed and did this. And you know how that story goes. It's very familiar. But here's the are you kidding me part about this. There's no record of Noah questioning God about building the ark. You know, like when you read in here now, and the Bible covers a lot of ground, and so there's times that the Bible is very brief and to the point. And sometimes it would be really nice if they expanded on things a little bit. But that's just the way it is, and we trust that. And you would think that, let's look at the situation. So there's Noah, probably in the middle of dry land with nothing around for miles and miles and miles. And I don't know, I believe there's some things, and I could be wrong on it, but at this time, I don't even know if rain had ever fallen. It was just, the earth was watered by dew and whatever else. And so the idea of God telling Noah this, and it seems to me that Noah just faithfully accepted this. Are you kidding me? Get it? Anyways, and so in this world where there was just nothing but rebellion and ungodliness, here's a man that has accepted some incredible direction and orders from God. And he does this. And so we don't hear him say, excuse me, God? Like, you want me to do what? Anyways. And so in the midst of this, he obeys faithfully. And we know the story. And the other little side thing to it, and it'd be nice to know more about this story, because, you know, when we hear the story of Noah, we hear about people mocking and stuff like that. But unless I'm missing it, and I would easily stand corrected, they don't even talk about that. So I think there's some assumptions made on that. Or was there actually... That was actually somewhere else where they talked about that, where the people of the day just made him look like fools. Or they... Oh, Peter might come. Okay, and so it might come somewhere else. But really, on this, the people out there who didn't believe would think that this man is crazy and stuff. But you would think at some point, this is a thought I have, at some point... When they start seeing animals parading to the ark, and I don't think they had tranquilizer guns, and I don't think they had helicopters to go gather these. So these animals were coming on their own, and after Noah's telling the people about this, some people, you'd think there'd be some that might just knock on the door and say, excuse me, Noah, do you mind if I just hop along? Like, there's something big happening here. And you know what? There seems to be something here that maybe we should just maybe get on board, but that didn't happen. And I always think that you would almost think that somebody there, even as evil as the life is, some of them would twig into this and say, hey, there's God is working here. But anyways, they didn't, so are you kidding me? Okay, so we'll move on now because, my goodness, Moses is my next story, and I'm going to be brief on this because... Moses is a man who, you know, we all know the story of this and how he reluctantly goes back and he actually challenges Pharaoh and through the power of God, he ends up leading the nation of Israel that basically was incubated in Egypt out. And of course, they get themselves trapped against the Red Sea, and then the Pharaoh comes with his army, and it looks pretty grim. And here these people are, and they start questioning Moses and questioning God. And miraculously, God provides the division of the Red Sea. He gets them across on dry land through the Red Sea. They get to the other side. They see the destruction of the Egyptian army and everything. And that should have a lasting impression on us, wouldn't you think? Like, if 3 days ago, Josh, something like that happened, I think you'd be on a pretty good high about God, wouldn't you? Yes, you would think so. So they get on the other side, and there they go. And of course, they're in the desert. And, well, let's just read what happens in Exodus 15, 22 to 27, 3 days later. Then Moses led Israel from the Red Sea, and they went into the desert of Shur. For 3 days they traveled in the desert without finding water. When they came to Marah, they could not drink its water because it was bitter. That is why the place is called Marah. Okay. So the people grumbled against Moses, saying, "What are we to drink? Are you kidding me?" Then Moses cried out to the Lord and showed him a piece of wood. He threw it into the water, and the water became sweet. And there the Lord made a decree and the law, and it goes on. But basically that was the gist of this, that after only 3 days with what the Lord had already done for them, are you kidding me? They're complaining? And do you not think that if he led you through the Red Sea, he would faithfully do this? And then, not much right after that, after they've had their drink, they start getting hungry. And guess what they do again? They complain. And so then Exodus 16 goes on to explain about how God provided the manna and quail. And this has fallen from the sky, folks. Just take note of that. So the kinds of miracles that God provided to the children of Israel at that time should have had them just walking on cloud nine and everything else. But you know what? As time goes on and we go later into Exodus, in chapter 32, Moses goes up on the mountain and spends quite a bit of time there with God as the Ten Commandments are formed. And of course, at this point in time, the Israelites are waiting below. And before he even leaves the top of the mountain, God says to him, "You're not going to believe this, but those guys down there have sort of given up on you. And so what are they doing? They're building an idol. They're building a golden calf. And if you want to get on the bad side of God, if you read the Bible, if you want to get on the bad side of God, build yourself an idol." He's not cool with that. He's just not. And so at this point, God tells Moses, "I'm ready to destroy them." And here's the, are you kidding me? Moses turns around and begs God for him to be patient with them. Like, and he says, "These are stiff-necked people." He says that a lot. And so, really, with this, this is another example of somebody saying, you know, at this point in time, Moses could have probably easily said, "Yeah, I'm done with them too, God." But he never. And so this is an example again where Moses stood up for them and begged for them, and when it's a time that it's unbelievable how they managed to go against God. Anyways, so hopefully that makes sense to you. And so the next one I want to go to is King Solomon. So you're starting to worry and say, okay, he's not that deep into the Old Testament already, but trust me, I'll keep this moving along. So with King Solomon, Solomon was, of course, known for his great wisdom. And in fact, he's described as being the smartest man on earth and ever in all of the time of earth. And so during his reign, there is there is probably the greatest time in the known in that time of the nation of Israel, and King Solomon helped bring them to that point. For instance, if you read in the Bible, it in that section, it tells you of riches beyond belief, like gold was just everywhere, like things were made of gold, and if you didn't make them of gold, you made them of silver and stuff. The amount of riches of the country was amazing, and God built his temple. He'd in fact reserved the time for the building of the temple to be for Solomon's reign. King David never got to have that privilege. It was Solomon that got that. And it was amazing what went into this temple and how it was built. It's also known in this time that the territory of Israel was at its greatest. This is when the reach of to my knowledge, the reach of Israel was way beyond the borders that it sits in now. And it was really an expansive nation. And along with this, the world power, and it was a time of world power for Israel. Other countries would come. The Queen of Sheba came, and there were other rulers and stuff that would come. And Israel was really a hub of power in that known world. And so that all comes through King Solomon. And it's amazing. And imagine if you went if you happened to be at that time and saw this temple and stuff, what you would see there, you would just say, and saw the riches, you would just say, are you kidding me? Like, this is just fantastic. This is amazing. Well, however, let's see, I better just double check my Bible reading. I'm coming from left field here, so you got to bear with me. You're not going to get a smooth delivery. Okay. Yes, but in this time, and I'm going to read from 1 Kings 11, 1 to 13. I think, 10, 23, and 24. I'll do that one first. I missed that one, so. Okay, King Solomon was greater in riches and wisdom than all the other kings of the earth. The whole world sought audience with Solomon to hear the wisdom God had put in his heart. Yes, and so that's just a little brief phrase from the Bible, just supports what I've said. Okay, however, as the years went on, and in Solomon's later days, when he was starting to get older, there were some questionable things, very, very questionable things that came about. And so I'm just going to read this. King Solomon, however, loved many foreign women besides Pharaoh's daughters, Moabites, Ammonites, Edomites, Sidonians, Hittites. They were from nations from which the Lord had told Israelites, you must not intermarry with them because they will surely turn your hearts after their gods. Nevertheless, Solomon held fast to them in love. He had 700 wives of royal birth and 300 concubines, and his wives led him astray. Are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? 700 wives. Solomon had 700 wives. Is that wise? I'm not going to judge that. I'm just going to say that's what I think. This was a different time and a different age. Anyways, but along with that, it was the signs of Solomon in his wisdom at the time started down a trail that you would think he would not go. His reign was very successful and everything else. And then as I read on here, Solomon grew old. His wives turned his heart after other gods, and his heart was not fully devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. He followed Ashtoreth, the goddess of Sidonians, and Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. So Solomon did evil in the eyes of the Lord. He did not follow the Lord completely, as David his father had done. On a hill east of Jerusalem, Solomon built a high place for Chemoth, the detestable god of Moab, and for Molech, the detestable god of the Ammonites. And he did the same for all the foreign wives who burned incense and offered sacrifices to their gods. And so here we have a man that for his whole life had a legacy of building the nation for God. But in the end, are you kidding me? Things went a different way. And I think that at this point in time, this takes us to the time when God set the stage for the decline of the kingdom of Israel. He had seen enough, and it must have broken his heart to see what the kinds of things that were happening in this decline. And this is the, and from here, he provides that the kingdom soon gets divided into two kingdoms, and eventually there are some kings in the time. It just leads to a time of turmoil, and it quickly goes from a time of peace to a time and wealth and being in harmony with God, to quickly going into a time of chaos and just further decline and decline and decline, till it comes to a point when God actually sends King Nebuchadnezzar in, and actually the exile happens, and basically the temple is destroyed, and it's just to the point that God is going to is simply going to just eliminate what is there right now and then work to starting fresh. And during that time, I just have one more that I want to share with you, and that is Elijah. And it was during this time, shortly after Solomon, when the kingdoms are divided, and at this time, the leadership is actually killing prophets, and the foreign gods are the things that is the common worship in the country. It just has gone to something unbelievably bad. And it was, this is the time of Elijah, who is an incredible leader for God. And here again is an example of this pattern, where at a time when you have a nation where it's all corrupt and bad, you have someone that's a strong leader for God, and that's Elijah. And so you might say, well, we know Elijah, but it's always kind of, when I read this, I thought, well, here's Elijah's handle: the Tishbite prophet from Tishbe in Gilead. So can you just see his business card? Hi, I'm Elijah. I'm the Tishbite prophet from Tishbe in Gilead. I thought that was kind of cute. Anyways, Elijah tells King Ahab that God is bringing a drought, and that's in Kings 17, 1 to 6. And now Elijah the Tishbite from Tishbe in Gilead said to Ahab, and Ahab was the king of Israel, "As the Lord, the God of Israel, lives, whom I serve, there will be neither dew nor rain in the next few years except at my word." Then the word of the Lord came to Elijah, "Leave here, turn eastward, and hide in the Kereth Ravine, east of the Jordan. You will drink from the brook, and I have ordered the ravens to feed you there." So he did that, and the Lord had told him. He went to the Kereth Ravine, east of Jordan, and stayed there. And the ravens did bring him bread and meat in the morning, and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And this was at a time that his life was in danger. And this is a time when, and I forget who it was, but there was another man of God that actually stowed away some of the prophets to protect him. Otherwise, they would have been destroyed because of the evilness of what was going on in the country. Okay, and so this leads us, and so he stayed there for a while, but then the drought got so bad that the brook dried up, so then he was sent. In Kings 17, 7 to 16, they tell us the next direction where Elijah is to go. Okay, and this is the story, the widow of Zarephath. And this is one of the ones that for some reason strikes me and stuck with me that I kind of liked. So sometime later, the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. The word of the Lord came to him, "Go at once to Zarephath of Sidon and stay there. I have commanded a widow in the place to supply you with food." And at this time, things were very, very grim. This drought was seriously taking hold. So he went to Zarephath, and when he came to the town gate, a widow was gathering sticks. He called to her and asked, "Would you bring me a little water in a jar so I may have a drink?" And as she was going to get it, he called, "And bring me, please, a piece of bread." "As surely as the Lord your God lives," she replied, "I don't have any bread, only a handful of flour in a jar and a little oil in a jug. And I am gathering a few sticks to take home and make a meal for myself and my son, that we may eat it and die." Elijah said to her, "Don't be afraid. Go home and do as you have said. But first, make a small cake of bread for me from what you have to bring, and bring it to me, and then make something for yourself and your son. For this is what the Lord, God of Israel, says: the jar of flour will not be used up, and the jug of oil will not run dry until the day the Lord gives rain in the land." She went away and did as Elijah had told her. So there was food every day for Elijah and for the woman with her family. For the jar of flour was not used up, and the jug of oil did not run dry. It kept it in keeping with the word of the Lord spoken by Elijah. Now, that's sort of the first part of this story. And this is, again, where I say it would really be nice when you read the Bible and stuff, you get to this, and then that's all the story tells you. Like, it would be nice to hear a little bit about the woman's reaction. Like, did she say, "Oh, you're amazing. You are certainly a man of God that you can do this. That every day I can go and I can just take flour and this, you know, and just keep doing this and doing this and doing this." Like, this is a miracle she's experiencing every day. And it would be nice to see that she says, "Your God is," and notice she always refers to him as "your God." And it would be really good if she would recognize this and say, "God is," you know. But it doesn't seem. She just seems, you know, and it might be how the Bible is written. I don't know. But I suspect not, because, Elijah obviously stayed around there for a while because she kept, and he might have been a boarder or something like that. Anyways, for a while, and so she kept feeding him. And so, later on, though, sometime later, the son of the woman who owned the house became ill, and he grew worse and worse and finally stopped breathing. I think that means he died. She said to Elijah, "What do you have against me, man of God? Did you come to remind me of my sin and kill my son?" And so it goes on here, and it ends up being that Elijah takes her son and, actually praying to God, manages to bring him back to life. And it's only at about that point where the woman reacts and says, "Now I know that," in verse 24, "I know that you are a man of God and that the word of the Lord from your mouth is the truth." And so I think she's starting to soften up a bit. But it would be nice to know whether or not she then truly developed a commitment to the Lord and was faithful to God. We just don't know. But some of her reaction would make me say, I think when I read that portion, I said, "Are you kidding me?" So anyway, sticking with my theme there a little bit. Okay, and so I could go on, and there's many, many, many more. But at this point, I'm going to work towards a conclusion. But the moving ahead to the time of Jesus on earth, and I just quickly want to just say, Jesus came to earth as a helpless babe, born of a virgin in a stable. Now that is pretty amazing. Are you kidding me? The king of the whole world and everything coming in this humble fashion. That's amazing. And he was worshipped by shepherds and foreign kings. So in the land that he was in, it was foreigners from other places that actually came and worshipped him. And the shepherds, can you imagine? There they are. They are out in the dark. And they must be very familiar with the sky because their internet was down then. And so that on their downtime, they weren't able to browse Google and entertain. So they would be very familiar with what happens in the heavens. And when this broke forth, can you imagine? I don't even think that they even said, are you kidding me? They just, and this happened. And so, but the thing that really is the are you kidding me part that comes to play when we realize that the religious leadership of the day rejected Jesus and treated him as an enemy. And that, to me, is in this whole story. And, of course, that was by God's design and everything because there was a bigger purpose there. But still, in some ways, it's just as amazing. And you say, are you kidding me? And the last thing that I want to point out is in Matthew 27, 50 to 54. And so I'll go way over there. And this is at the time when Jesus' death on the cross. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and rocks split. Okay, and it goes on. The tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into this holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, surely he was the Son of God. And so the are you kidding part about this is that even though in the established temple and all these guys, they had their own rules and they had nothing to do with God in terms of, or nothing to do with Jesus. But the fact that that veil was rent in that temple, this, if I'm understanding this correctly, was the curtain that separated the entrance to the area called the Holy of Holies, where only the priest entered once a year. And this is where God would meet man in that temple. And it was only the high priest that would go in. And I'm thinking that that was a very nervous day, and the high priest would always be very happy to get through that day, because if he did anything wrong or he didn't prepare himself properly and he went in there, he would be struck dead. So this was a very serious location in the temple. And again, I've heard this, and I don't know if it's true or not, but I believe that no one else could enter there. And so they actually tied a rope to the high priest's leg so that if it didn't go well, they could drag him out, his body out, because they couldn't enter or they would be struck dead. And so that this veil is torn and rent, you would think would have had a tremendous impression on the people, the Pharisees and all these guys, that they would have recognized, hey. But they never. Are you kidding me? What they did was they just covered it up and they just continued to go after Christians and persecute Christians, and it never, ever clicked and registered with them. And so, you know, with that, those are just some of the observations I had, and I'm going to stop. I can read the time. And so, we'll just leave it at this. And it says, where are we now? Well, when you look at all the happenings in our world today in relation to the Bible and our Christian faith, do you ever find yourself asking, are you kidding me? And that's...